This is Follow Spot, San Diego Theater Scene's weekly podcast focused on the people who make theater in San Diego County. With news, views, and conversation to inform you of what's happening in San Diego's exciting theater community. And now here is your host, Dale Morris.
Hello and welcome to San Diego Theater Scene Follow Spot podcast. Today is April 22nd. We are in the Grand Dressing Room of Six at Penn Theater, which will very soon become Compass Theater. I'm Dale Morris. I'm sitting with Michael Thomas Tower, the lovely Jenny Prisk, and Kelly Lechinsky. Hi, Kelly. How are you today?
Hey, pretty good.
Good.
Well, I noticed I wasn't as
and
lovely
she's lovely
as Jenny.
Too.
Oh, well, you are. Well, I saw you on stage last night, and you were certainly lovely with those big high heels on and dressed to the nines, seducing that man who
right.
came on stage with you. So
that's one of my favorite jobs in life.
Yeah.
Tell me more. I wasn't there, and I missed it.
I got to do it all seated, so the woohoo.
Oh. Oh.
Actually, she was in Michael Thomas Tower's play, One Down.
That's correct.
And it was a very good show as part of Funny Bones. Mm-hmm. Our show, tell us about Funny Bones real quick, Michael.
Well, it's our challenge production, Challenge 3, the third one of them that we've done, four comedies about death. And
what a hoot.
I suppose you're trying to make us laugh, aren't you? Trying to make us laugh.
Four very different comedies about
very
death.
Very different comedies.
Well, it's off to a good start. I was able to see two of the shows last night, yours and David Wiener's.
David Wiener's, and we'll be talking to in a little bit later.
He's one of our guests. And right now, let's just chat about what's going on in town. What have we got? Groucho,
A Life in Review is coming up at Onstage Playhouse. That opens on May 9th.
So, you know, Onstage Playhouse is not that far of a drive. And they are doing work that is, they're called community theater. And of course, they use community theater actors. But these are actors that act all the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
These are directors that direct all the time. They work their butts off at their normal jobs during the day. They rush to the theater to get dressed and do their work at night. They are doing quality work down there. I've seen several of their shows.
One of my favorite theater experiences was a show I did there.
What was it, Kelly?
The Odd Couple female version.
Did you?
I had a hoot with that show.
Now, who directed that show?
That was Jeff Gastauer.
I do not know the person.
No, he's I think in San Francisco now. I believe he works for airlines.
Yeah. Well, what we're saying is, don't take this term community theater as a downer or something, because it's not.
You know, community theaters around here to be successful have to keep up with the vast array of small professional theaters that are in here.
So their bar has to go up.
Their bar has to go up, and it does.
Yeah, so we're not just talking about...
The last thing that I saw it on stage was Night of the Iguana.
Good
Lord.
That's
not something you normally expect a community theater to be doing, and they did a very good job.
And you know, you go in there, and I've been on there, down there on Thursdays, Fridays, and you've got nice houses in there, nice houses, mm-hmm. lots of people in there. The community is supporting these plays, and more people are starting to drive down to Onstage Playhouse to see their plays, and we're very happy about that. But there's other good community theaters in town. What were we talking about before, Michael, with Pow Pack?
Talking about Pow Pack, recently they did The Rabbit Hole, which seems to be rather a coup d'etat that they were able to even do that play. I think it was the...
It had just won the Pulitzer Prize.
And I think it's the first time it's been performed in this area.
It was a premiere. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think it was the first time anybody really had had the rights to it other than a large professional company.
Yeah, and I wanted to get over to see it and was not able to.
I'm proud to say that I did. And
I did
see it.
Wow.
I got up there to see it. Jamie and I went up there to see it and were knocked out by it. Here you have a local cast doing very, very fine work. I could find no complaints with that cast. The directing, I would hire who, I don't remember who the director was for that play.
It may have been Kate Hewitt. No, maybe not.
I can't remember.
She didn't do that one.
I wish I had the
name.
I got
an email from Kate telling how good it was, but
yeah.
She was.
I wouldn't hesitate to hire that director down here. And
well,
some
we'll
of
be
the
looking
actors.
Them up then.
Yeah. Yeah. As a matter of fact, Compass Theater is doing American Buffalo in January, and the kid who played the kid in
Rabbit hole.
Thank you, dear.
What would he do without his women, Kay?
I've asked to come and audition for the role of Bobby, and I tell you, he's got a leg up. So, what we're talking about here, on and on, is that go see these community theaters.
I throw in another quick one?
Dear.
Scripps Ranch.
Yeah.
Scripps, oh, I love Scripps Ranch.
Yes, and Jill Drexler, one of our finest actors, who's currently on.
Jill who?
Oh, I saw you cozying up to Jill Drexler
seems like
on Sunday
night.
Her
about four
wait,
nights a
wait,
week.
Wait! Here it comes. I play Jill Drexler's boyfriend.
You're the envy of every man in town,
yes, I am.
Including her husband, Roger, I might say,
oh, my.
Who, when we arrived at Signet on Sunday night for the opening of Hysterical Blindness, said, sit behind me because that's she plays on this side of the stage. So we did, and we saw all that she played.
Get up to see shows at Scripps Ranch.
Yes.
I just saw Kelly mm-hmm. in a show up there, the what girls?
The O'Connor Girls.
And oh, that's a great show.
I loved it.
I could not believe the set. Mm-hmm. The acting was fabulous. Mm-hmm. The set was incredible.
Ted Crittenden. That was a great set.
Ted Crittenden did a set here once for Floyd Gaffney. I can't remember the name of the show, but Floyd Gaffney rented Six at Penn, and Ted Crittenden did an incredible set. Who have we missed? We've talked about PALPAC, Scripps, Coronado.
Well, Lamplighter still hasn't found a place, but are they still looking? Do we know if Lamplighter is still actively trying to find a venue?
I saw Judy Hughes at mm-hmm. the opening of Hysterical Blindness the other night, and I should have asked her. But I think they're dead in the water, and I hope that's wrong. I hope that's wrong, but I think they're dead in the water. We're missing somebody.
Patio.
Yes.
And Coronado. We haven't mentioned Coronado yet. Coronado. They're already with Blythe Spirit.
That's right. One of my favorite plays.
Done that show three times.
Have you?
I have. I've been both wives.
Oh, you've been both wives. I saw you at Scripps Ranch.
You did.
I did.
Actually.
And mm-hmm. I've played Madame Arcati at the North Coast Rep.
Oh,
yes.
Lovely.
And I don't know whether there are any other roles after that.
I said in my bio, if I play it one more time and I'm only appropriate for the role of Charles, that's when I retire.
Did we talk about this before? Is there four now? Maybe
four
five?
Active. Yeah. I don't know if Theatrics still considers themselves, or if they're still affiliated with ACT, but Onstage, PALPAC, Coronado, and Patio, I think, are the four remaining members of the Associated Community Theaters.
And the reason we're talking about it today is that we hope that you will support these community theaters. They are doing worthwhile work. You mm-hmm. won't get there and go, oh, my God, why did we come see this?
Mm-hmm.
So get out there.
I think it's good to remember that for many of us, that's where we came from. I know
people.
I certainly did.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah. You don't become a professional without getting your foot wet somewhere.
Right. And so the fact that they're around and producing good stuff and high,
echelon quality.
Stuff, high quality, that's a better word, yes, is a good sign.
Jenny, thank you. Jenny's going to be back in just a few minutes to give us some reviews and talk about theater that's going on around town. This is Dale Morris. This is San Diego Theater Scene Follow Spot Podcast, and we'll be right back.
Adjusting to married life is hard enough, but when a conservative young lawyer and an irrepressible bride set up house in a minuscule fifth-floor Manhattan walk-up with no heat, a hole in the skylight, and an oddball neighbor who climbs through their apartment to get to his own, things can get out of hand. PALPAC, Poway's Community Theater, presents Neil Simon's classic comedy Barefoot in the Park, Friday through Sunday, April 25th through May 18th. Tickets are $15 and can be purchased online at palpac.org.
Welcome back to San Diego Theater Scene Follow Spot Podcast. It's April 22nd, and we're here today with Jenny Prisk. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Dale.
I'm Dale Morris. I'm here with Michael Thomas Tower and Kelly Lipchinski. And, Jenny, you're going to talk to us today about three shows. What are they?
Well, the three shows that I saw this last weekend all have love as their theme. La Gaviota, which is Claudio Ragosa's not translation, but his version of Chekhov's The Seagull. And, of course, that is greatly about unrequited love for people, for art. And they've done a very interesting rendition directed by Glenn Paris. Then the second one is New Village Art's Prelude to a Kiss, which we haven't seen in San Diego for a while. And, of course, that's about love and how when people change in a love relationship, how if it's true love,
it never goes astray. It stays fast, it stays true, and they've done a beautiful production at New Village Arts. And then, of course, one that's very close to home, to you, Dale Morris, is another one looking for love, or How to Be Loved in Hysterical Blindness, currently running at Signet, and this is a Backyard Productions production.
Those are three great shows. Now, whenever someone says to me, you know, that show was interesting, I start going, all right, interesting. Now, what does that mean? You know, interesting. They did an interesting version. All right, help me out understanding that word.
Interesting. Yes, it's close to the comment to an actor after a show, you've done it again.
Exactly.
Beautiful makeup,
yeah.
Lovely costumes.
Yes. Nice. You want to go for a drink?
I love those shoes.
Let me put it this way, because I so admire Ion Theatre and the work that Claudio and Glenn are doing. And I was expecting more surprises, more shocks in this version called La Gaviota, which translates, of course, into Spanish as The Seagull. I was expecting more shocks because of the nature of Ion, and they didn't appear. To my mind, at the end of the show, which is long, it's 3+ hours, I feel as though I've seen The Seagull by Chekhov staged in Mexico. And even though there are some very fine performances, I was particularly taken with the actress or actor, I still get confused with
Me
this,
too.
Who plays Paula Elena Garcia. This is Catalina Maynard. She does a beautiful rendition of worry and love and caring. Claudio himself plays the beleaguered artist, which is always a very hard role to play, and yet, of course, Claudio plays that well. Trina Kaplan is delightful as the grandmother. She just gets better and better every time I see Trina on stage, and she at one point dances on stage, and I had to sneak a look at her husband of 60 years, Ted, and he was leaning forward and his eyes were shining. And I mean, I know I'm not even talking about the performance, but to my mind, somehow that's what a performance is about, is watching what happens to other people in the audience. In the second act and during an interlude, a whole tent is erected on stage, and this takes a good 10 minutes to do. And unfortunately, I don't really see how it furthers the production. Now, telling you why it's erected and what happens around it, I'm going to spoil everything for those of you who are going to go, because it's running until May 17 at the Lab off Alvarado Canyon. However, it does detract, because too much time is taken and we're losing some of the impetus of the story at the time. It is wonderful to see Linda Castro back on our stages. She, of course, is enchanting and intriguing and very strong, plays a very, very strong female. So if you love Chekhov, then definitely see this production. If you're looking for shocks and something to really tip your hat to, I have to say that for me, unfortunately, it didn't deliver.
You know what? Ion really are risk takers.
Yes.
They are willing to take a risk, both Glenn Paris and Claudio Rigosa and their entire ensemble. They are risk takers, and I applaud them for that. And you know what? They can't be expected to ring the bell every time.
If we did, I think the audiences might get a little bit frightened sometimes, although I do know that Ion is certainly aspiring to excellence,
yes,
and that this whole year they're devoting to Chekhov,
yes,
with their continuous readings.
No, it's not.
It's Ibsen.
Ibsen, yes.
Do you know I do this every time I mix Chekhov and Ibsen? Is it because they're both so depressing? And maybe it's that I've done this. In fact, Kim, my husband's done this after when we come out of a theatre sometimes. He says, okay, who was the playwright, Ibsen or Chekhov, because he knows I'm going to get them mixed up. So that's very, very unprofessional
on
my part.
So the bottom line, Jenny, is?
The bottom line is, if you love Chekhov, go, because you will love the words, you will love the acting. The performance is another standout, is Sarah Beth Morgan for me, who plays the ingenue actress, Nina. You'll love the words. There is a beautiful setting. Having it set around revolution in Mexico brings a change to it. There are things done with the ending of the play that I disagree with and think they could have been done very, very differently and with far more drama. However, I'm not saying that it's a projection you shouldn't see. There are some very beautiful performances, and the words of Chekhov ring true, but also so do Rigosa's, because he has written some astounding lines.
He's amazing.
And some beautiful poetry within in this production, and it's worth it just to hear the dialogue.
All right, folks, there you have it. It's worth it to go see this play.
Let me ask a question. I don't know this much about the way ION operates, but is it likely that what a person will see toward the closing of this run will be different from what you saw at the beginning of it?
Great question, Michael, and I agree with you that yes, I feel that perhaps they were still growing into it on opening night. And, you know, I think opening night should be held at least a week into the run. No, I'm serious about this, because we, those of us who've been on stage or behind the scenes, know how tough that can be. Dale, I know it's not your favorite night, because we are really so geared in a very different way to pitching that performance to whoever is in the audience and what we want them to say that night, that sometimes the beautiful truths and the depths of all that poetry of the production or the words are just not there yet.
You're depending on instinct just to get you through it.
You are. Yes, instinct and a lot of gin. After the show. And I do believe that on that night there was a lot of tension. It's a masterpiece that they've undertaken, and they've undertaken it in a very noble way. And I agree that the later in the run, in fact, I'd be very tempted to go again in that last week, because I think, rightly so, I would see a very different show.
I wonder if they might do cutting some really rather drastic things, because it sounds like at 3+ hours, that's a lot.
Well, Glenn did tell me beforehand we've spent a lot of time cutting already. But you're right, they may well do that. It's not a finished work yet. Mm-hmm. It's still in its finishing stages.
That's
all right, I was just going to say, the cast they have are an excellent group to help them to find the truths which may allow them to let some of the unnecessary script go.
Yeah, they've put together an incredible cast. Mm-hmm. I'd say this to Glenn or Claudio or anybody else. If you're going to put on a 3-hour play, entertain me.
I have to ask this question because I have not been in the ION space at the lab. If you're going to put me in a seat for 3 hours, I have to ask, are they comfortable seats or folding chairs?
They're seats. They're not folding chairs. However, they are not the most comfortable. They're hard-backed. And for someone of Kim, my husband's height, who is 6'1", by the end of it, he had to de-kink somewhat because he was really struggling with that.
What we're hoping is that here at San Diego Theater Scene, and Jenny, I know, feels the same way, get out there and support ION Theater by seeing La Gaviota, and we want your opinion.
Yes,
call us.
Yes, and next up for them is going to be a wonderfully passionate version of Streetcar.
Yes.
Oh.
Ooh,
and the leading actors in that will, I think, probably blow you right through the back walls.
if you've got a comment about this review from Jenny and our comments about it, you can call us at 619-688-9210. You can leave a message, or you can leave your number, and one of us will call you back to get your comment.
Or if you go to the podcast directory page, there is a place there where you can send it right into us.
Oh, thank you, Michael. That even makes more sense. All right, moving on, Jenny.
Well, now I'm looking at Prelude to a Kiss, the well-known and much-loved Craig Lucas play, which takes us on a few twists and turns. This is directed by Delicia Turner Sonnenberg, so I think most of us walk into a theater expecting great stuff, and she, of course, delivers.
And she'll be with us next week.
Oh, wonderful. Oh, well, that will be exciting to have her here. Prelude to a Kiss, currently playing at New Village Arts, a beautiful production, directed by the inimitable Delicia Turner Sonnenberg. And as many of you will know, if you've seen Prelude to a Kiss, this requires a flight of imagination because you have two people morphing into each other at the time of a wedding, which is beautifully staged and very subtly done. The backdrop for this is a series of steel trees. And at the moment of the turning or the changing, the trees turn and the leaves drop. And the rest of the scenery is also cast in steel. Now, I'm not going to steal the secrets and tell you all about that, but they are moved in and out very, very simply, very easily, and they create some marvelous backdrops for the current scene that is taking place. Christiane Kerner and Joshua Everett Johnson, as the lovers, do a beautiful job together. There's a lovely electricity and a lovely chemistry. And in the end, as always, you come out of this production, feeling good about love, and knowing that when people change in a relationship that truly loves, the love will last. And that's what's so beautiful through Prelude to a Kiss. Charlie Rindo is absolutely joyful in this production. He is growing so richly as an actor. And, of course, he has to become a female for a short amount of the time and then morph in and out from male and female. And he does it with such tenderness and such sweetness. And to watch he and Josh on stage together really is a very beautiful moment. When Lucas wrote it, he wrote it in the time of AIDS, and that was when AIDS first struck us all, and it was lovers seeing their partners change, and that was what gave him the first sense of how to write this play. It now
loving
plays
the soul even as the body ages, that youthful soul in the older body.
Yes, absolutely. And then he now uses the parallel of course, war, and how when many of our soldiers return from Afghanistan or from Iraq, their various spouses don't, or their partners don't know them as they did. And yet, as you said, Kelly, so aptly, that the soul remains the same, but the body, well, and some of the spirit has changed. And therefore, it's a very, very timely play for us right now.
Touching and wonderful. How long does that play run?
That play runs, and I should know that, but it's not actually here on the, wait a moment, it opened, of course, on April 19, and from memory, it runs. Now, why have they not got this? I tell theatres about this all the time. Put the finishing dates on the program.
All right, folks, you've just found a reason to drive up to Carlsbad.
Oh, there are many reasons to drive up to Carlsbad.
Yeah. And it runs April 19th through May 18th.
And that's at New Village Arts.
And the director, Delicia, will be with us here next week.
Yeah. Wonderful. Well, I know she'll have a lot of insight into what it was like for her to stage this production.
Jenny, I just love the way you talk about plays. I hope you can be with us more.
I want to point out, though, that we did see Prelude to a Kiss in San Diego, because Onstage did it about a year ago.
Okay, just that's right, they did too. Mm-hmm. And I didn't see that production, and now I wish I had, because I always think it's great to be able to compare them and see how different actors, different directors have taken one play and worked it with their own particular magic. And I just feel it's very hard for me to be extremely critical of anything I might see here, because I think I know and understand on small budgets how much passion is put into these productions. No matter how they may turn out, you know the heart and soul that's gone into them really counts for a lot.
Well, that's my kind of reviewer. That's what I like to hear. I mean, we can talk about the fact that a play failed in some way or another, but we find the positives in that play. Let's go on to Hysterical Blindness, which I believe is a story of an older man who finds love in Philadelphia or somewhere.
Well, we hope he finally has, you know, because there are many of us that have been working on this and watching this for a long time. But yes, Dale Morris does execute extremely well in this. He plays his role of the older man with a great deal of calm and serenity and a great deal of, I want to say, when I say touchy, no, it's touchingness, and I don't even know if that's a word, but it's very touching. And of course, how could you not be when you're playing opposite the beautiful and talented Jill Drexler?
Yes.
And of course, you've got a little bit pulling against you in that relationship in Hysterical Blindness running at Signet, because Debbie, the daughter, played with ferocity by the beautiful Jessica John, does not want her mother dating this funny old man, as she puts it, who keeps appearing in her kitchen when she comes home from a long night out. And yet it's lovely to watch the sweetness and development of their relationship. And of course, well, I can't give away the ending. I couldn't do that, because you'll have to go and see it. Are you having fun with Nick?
I am having so much fun with Nick, to be very honest about it. Nick is a probably an important role, but a small role.
There are no small roles.
No small roles, but just us small actors, you know.
Yes, well, that I would agree with.
But the real the real stars of this, it's Jessica John and Amanda Sitton and Jill Drexler. A story about three women kind of out there searching for love.
Searching for love, and there's a lot of sadness in some of it, but I have to say that the combination of Jessica John and Amanda Sitton on the stage is just glorious. It's delicious. They really do carry on like a couple of 80s girlfriends. The opening scene with Amanda backcombing her hair till it's about 10 feet off the top of her head at this bar and being so overwhelmed by everything that Jessica says. And Jessica's struggle to just find someone to love her. It's sad through the humor.
I think it could have been tragic. The scene where she's in the bar just throwing herself at the character of Rick. It's sad and borderline tragic to me.
Tragic for me because having had to do that for most of my dating life, you know, it's very painful to watch yourself there on the stage, you know. And I'm so glad that's all behind me now. Now, did I come away thinking that this would stay in my head forever? No, it's not that kind of play. There were moments in it where I kept thinking, is there a there in it? But the more I distance myself from hysterical blindness, the more I feel that struggle that we all have to be loved, to be accepted, to be found, to fit in, to belong. We're all struggling just with that sense of being somebody.
Yes.
And so many people feel that the only way they can be somebody is to belong to somebody else.
All right, so give me the bottom line on this now.
Hysterical Blindness. Backyard Productions at Signet's Rolando Theatre running through May 11. See it. If you want to relive the 80s, relive some of that music. I was bopping in the seat and up and down the aisles afterwards. If you want to see two of our gorgeous actors in town really belittle themselves.
Me
by
and
this,
Jessica Jones.
Yes, I'll get to that. Really thinking of Amanda Sitton and Jessica Jones at this point in their groovy clothing and their impossible high heels. And then, of course, to find this beautiful aging couple, yes, that's you, just finding sweet love in the corner of Jill's kitchen. Go and see it. It's delightful.
Jenny, thank you so very much. What's up with you now? What are you seeing next? You know?
Well, tonight, actually, I'm going to see The Glass Menagerie at the Old Globe. I've been hearing very mixed reviews on that. Then I think that's it for a little while. I've got some business travel coming up. And I'm also, though, I'm very excited about Saturday afternoon in Balboa Park judging the elementary schools in the San Diego Shakespeare Junior Festival.
Yeah,
and I asked for the elementary schools because I read to first graders each week and I love the littlies. And I'm dying to hear them wrap their tongues around Shakespeare.
Oh, well, we want to hear about that. When can we expect to have you back here?
Not for another month, Dale.
Not for another month.
No, that's right. So it'll be about once a month.
Okay.
And I'll save up a number of plays and bring them to you.
Thank you, dear. Always, always great. You look great, and we'll be talking to you again soon.
You don't really have to say that, thank you. This is radio, not television, but I appreciate you saying that.
That's okay. Well, you sound great.
Well, thank you.
You really,
sound thinner.
To be honest with you, you don't look all that good.
Stick to radio, Dale. And thank you.
But she sounds slimmer.
She sounds slimmer.
Oh,
this
you,
is Dale Morris with San Diego Theater Scene Follow Spot Podcast, along with Michael Thomas Tower and our own Kelly Lepchinski. We've been talking with Jenny Prisk. Stay tuned. We've got David Wiener here, and we're going to talk about theater and stuff. So hang around. We'll be right back.
A Jersey barfly suffers a stress-induced blindness. Can she find meaning in her relationships with her mother, her friends, and the men in her life? Laura Cahill's intimate drama, Hysterical Blindness, follows her journey to settle into a life that she lives rather than one that lives her. Backyard Productions presents Hysterical Blindness at Signet Theater April 20th through May 11th. Purchase tickets online at sdbackyardproductions.com or by calling 619-995-2225.
Welcome back to San Diego Theater Scene Follow Spot Podcast for April 22nd. This is Dale Morris with Michael Tower and Kelly Lepchinski. Wasn't Jenny Prisk great?
Oh, she's lovely.
You know, I wish we could have her more often than once a month, but at least we got her once a month, you know?
Lucky for that.
Lucky for that. Now, in this segment, we have with us David Wiener. David is a playwright, a writer, and all-around theater person, I think.
That sounds fair. Yeah, I'll go with that.
Welcome, David. You've got play right now in our festival. That's not why you were invited here today, but I'm glad that we can talk about that. What's the play you've got with us now?
This one is called Feeding Time at the Human House, and it's in the Challenge 3 Festival. And this is a two-hander, which are getting to be very popular these days, short plays, about 15, 20 minutes long. And advice to aspiring playwrights out there, if you want to get stuff actually produced, go on the internet and start to look for these short play festivals, because that, I think, is your best bet to sort of break beyond the reading and the staged reading level and actually get stuff produced, which is what it's all about.
15-minute plays are big now.
They are big, but I have heard a playwright complain. I have heard this complaint from playwrights who said that it seems now that many playwrights aren't able to write full-length productions anymore, that they can't flesh things out to two-hour productions because they are so busy getting produced at these 15-minute festivals. Do you think that that's a problem? Do you see that as a problem for playwrights?
It can be, but not for many playwrights I know. Generally, most playwrights I know who, let's be honest, very unlikely you'll make a living at this, so you have a day job, you're just so damn happy to get something produced rather than, you know, just read or submitted. The format is almost the secondary consideration. It's a different type of skill and focus. It's like you're doing a short story instead of, you know, a little novella, which is close to what a play is. So I'd never complain about it, but I'm sure there are people who do.
You know, I enjoy these festivals. I really do. I get a kick out of them. I was here last night, and here being Six at Penn Theater, where we're doing the Challenge 3 Festival, I saw your play. I saw Michael's play. I liked them both very much, and I like short plays. But it doesn't take the place for me of even a long one act. Or a 90-minute play or a two-hour play. It doesn't take the place of that for me.
Oh, I agree. The holy grail for writing is you want a full-length piece produced. And a lot of times, starting years ago, you started seeing the phenomenon of plays just being read to death or read to pieces. So you can get readings and staged readings now, but, you know, they sort of are passed off sometimes as a workshop when they're really not. And it's like, well, it got read, but now it's almost dead to the world. It's going to be very hard to get the thing produced. Or it gets read 5 or 6 times in different theaters, and that's it. Readings are great. I mean, they're tremendous, and they're a great way to get feedback and this kind of thing. But I sort of miss the days when you took your chances of getting the thing fully produced, because it's just a whole different experience, and you get a whole different opportunity to rewrite and improve the thing.
My introduction to you was the play The Master Forger, which I saw out at, help me, what was the name?
Yeah, I was out at Lakeside. It was Octad 1, Martin Garrish's operation, which was then being operated by Wayne Areca.
Exactly, mm-hmm. And I thoroughly enjoyed that show. I enjoyed Wayne's performance.
Oh, yeah.
In that show. And now I'm sure you got some readings with that, and then you got a production. Anything happened with it after that?
Yeah, actually, after that, we went to London after that, oddly enough, which I don't think happens much here locally. But the play was based on the biography of the forger called the Van Meegeren and Master Forger. That was written in 1967, and I read it in college. And I'd been trying to get a hold of the author for some years to see if anybody owned the playwrights. And then about 1999, I finally heard back from the guy. He was a retired member of the House of Lords, and he lived in the middle of nowhere in Ireland. And he said, the only thing going on at the moment is Sidney Pollack's production company is thinking about movie rights, but nobody's expressed any interest in playwrights. So about 2-3 months of negotiating, we had an agreement, and at that point I wrote the thing and tried to get it produced. And that was the first place we actually got it on stage.
Well, it was good. I enjoyed it.
Thank you.
And now what happened in London?
London, it was at a theater called The Tabard, which is a small theater. Basically, it's attached to a pub, but there's actually a full theater there. I'm not sure how many seats it was. And they did a full production, a slightly longer script. We had to cut some things out because there were resource limitations at TAD 1 in the Manhattan Playhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And that did very well. That got good reviews in the London trades and things like that. And hopefully it'll go on to do some other stuff, too.
Okay, now we're going to take just a brief break. When I come back, last week we had Claudio Regoza here, and we talked about his process. I'd like to spend a couple minutes with you talking about that.
Sure.
Okay? This is Dale Morris, San Diego Theater Scene Follow Spot Podcast. We'll be back after these announcements.
Wedding vows are just the beginning of a mystical adventure when an uninvited guest congratulates the new bride with a kiss that changes everything. Their souls exchange bodies, and it's far from a model honeymoon, as the groom searches for the spirit of his wife to find her love again in the body of a dying man. New Village Arts presents Prelude to a Kiss by Craig Lucas, April 19th through May 17th. For tickets, call 760-433-3245 or visit newvillagearts.org.
Welcome back to San Diego Theater Scene Follow Spot Podcast. Today we're talking with David Wiener, playwright, writer. And David, when we left, I said that I was going to ask you about your process. How do you go about writing a play?
I like to find a story first, and that's kind of fallen into disrepute over the past 15 or 20 years. A lot of focus now is almost on, there was some, I don't remember where I read this, but it was a very interesting essay on theater, and the title of it was Therapy, Not Theater. And it was sort of a description of the way people approach playwriting starting maybe 20, 30 years ago, suddenly became very internal. And they started to look at emotional states and psychological issues and things like that. Whereas before that, it had been, what's a good story? What's a good involving story with characters you're interested in and care about, even if you don't like them? For instance, The Art Forger was sort of a cross between Peter Lorre and, David Niven. You didn't much care for him, but he was interesting. You wanted to know what was going to happen to him. So my focus is generally, what's a story that's good enough to keep people interested and not, you know, screaming to get out of the theater for 2 hours with an intermission? That's a long time people to sit.
I'm glad I'm not an intellectual.
Yeah.
You know, I'm glad that I don't have to worry about problems like the crap you just talked about. You find a story, right?
Yeah. I mean, as an actor or even an audience member, that therapy, not theater thing is something I have noticed. There are parts that I just don't want to do because they're so heavy and psychological. And same thing, there are plays I just don't want to go see because I want a story. I want to be entertained.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I think another thing you've seen is there's sort of a lot of what they call narcissistic personality disorder in psychology creeping into, you know, what's supposed to be entertainment on stage. And a lot of it's not very interesting to watch, but people will shut up and swallow it because they're sort of being pressured, well, this is, you know, intellectual.
This
and
is
it's
intellectual.
They're supposed to like.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You know, not what we ought, that kind of thing. And boy, you better shut up or people are going to think you're dumb or you didn't go to college or whatever.
Yeah. So you find that story.
Absolutely.
You go out
That's
there,
mine.
You find that story. What's next?
What's next is, unless you're the kind of a playwright who's like the top tier, who can just call up a theater and say, here, I want to do this, you think about the resources. What are the resources you're going to have? And anybody who's hoping to be a playwright, or most people who are working at it and even getting stuff produced, even though they work a day job, are always being told, you better write cheap. You'd better write cheap. And unfortunately, this is like the second thing you wind up thinking of. You know, how you got to keep it to four or five people. You might be able to double, you know, but you better be careful about that. The theaters you're going to query and submit and pitch to, what do they have? Can they put this thing on?
When you say query, you're going to send out a letter to them saying, this is what I've got.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There are theaters that, you know, people I know and personal contacts, but much more numerous are the people that you just contact by letter or with a query package or this kind of thing. And you also look for submission opportunities. Those are posted on the web.
You start thinking about that even before you write the play?
While I'm writing it, because you have to keep it in mind or you're going to do things like, which you do see as rookie mistakes, a cast of 25, you know, those kind of things they used to put on with, you know, Kaufman and Hart, these enormous casts and five dogs and a pig on stage and a peacock and all this stuff. And I think a lot of people are sharp enough to realize they just nobody can afford to do that stuff anymore. Even major regionals are careful about spending a lot of money. You'll see some major productions at major regionals here locally. We can see Broadway theater 3-4 times a year because these are shows from out of town. They're being put on by investors from out of town.
Touring show.
Yeah, and a touring show. And these can be quite lavish, really impressive shows. But the shows that are put on here, even if they're like West Coast premieres or things like that, they're not going to be as lavish. The casts are going to be smaller, and people just have to be careful.
So while you're conjuring up the story, while you're dealing with that, you're keeping in mind, hey, I can't write a cast for a cast of thousands.
Yeah, and another thing, while you're doing that, the convenient part is what you want to be able to give the actors parts they would like to play. Something that's appealing not only to the artistic director and the literary manager who are going to make the decision of whether or not you get a chance to put this thing on, but you want to make it appealing to the actors. And that was one nice thing about the Forger. You know, this was a very appealing part to actors. You know, he was a rogue. He was successful. He had all these dark things rolling around. So it worked out very well to keep those two things in mind.
And the next step is?
Well, the next step is I generally will do less of a detailed outline than I used to. I will still outline. And the outline is basically to make sure the machinery works. Does one scene lead into another? Does it keep people interested? Does the thing function properly? Is the intermission coming at the right time? And, you know, is the climax right and all this kind of thing? Starting out, you're going to wind up with incredibly long outlines because you don't have that confidence or experience. But if you've done a few of them and had the good fortune to get them produced and they did okay or did well, you'll wind up generally putting up a smaller outline, which is less pressure on you. It works better.
The smaller outline being, help me understand that.
Sure. Basically, it's not necessarily a detailed scene breakdown, but it's major events. For me, you know.
This leads to this.
Right, because I'm interested in story. You know, what's going to keep people interested and make it worthwhile watching on stage. So it's like what moves the thing along from scene to scene.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to actually do every single little scene, but it's like major events. You'd think of it like a novel, something like that. Oh, well, you know, Charlie loses his job. Well, what's he going to do now?
You're working, I believe, right now, a full-time job out at La Jolla Playhouse.
Actually, no, that was for the season. That was for last season. Yeah. I was their dramaturgy associate after I did a literary internship under Adam Greenfield, who's in New York now.
Yeah.
And I worked under Shirley Fishman for their season last year. Right now, I am with Sushi Performance and Visual Art.
Cool. So you get off work, you go home, maybe you have a bite to eat or something, and start writing?
As much as I can. A lot of it is maintaining the marketing and sales aspect of it, keeping the lists of people you can contact personally. There's an A-list and a B-list and a C-list. Who do you know in theater that you can pitch to this thing personally? And the other lists are, all right, you get down to the point where it's a little more cold, and then the bottom list is just a plain cold query letter to their literary manager or artistic director. So it's surprising how time-consuming the Willy Loman aspect of this thing is.
The marketing, selling the damn thing.
Yeah, you've got your case full of samples and you're walking around.
Okay, so we're still talking about marketing thing. You haven't even got it written yet.
Yeah, well, that's basically the, you know, what you're also doing while you're writing it is maintaining your marketing information and databases. For me, after I get the outline done, is then I start writing chunks and bits of dialogue that will come to mind. And I think that happens to every writer.
Yeah.
You get inspired with bits of exchanges between the characters and things like that. And you just keep them in a stack and slot them into
the
proper scene.
That's exactly what I do.
Yeah, exactly right. That's how it works. And then you start to flesh it out more and more. And, you know, eventually you get something that's close to a reading draft where you can sit down with some friends' ears and, you know, beer and pizza and actually hear the damn thing read back to you instead of mumbling to yourself constantly. I read an interview with Marcia Mason. She was talking about after she married Neil Simon, one of the things that bothered her, she'd go past this office and she'd hear this kind of thing. She's like, what in the hell are you doing? And he's just reading his dialogue back to himself.
Absolutely. Yeah. We're almost out of time in this segment, but when we come back, I want to talk about plays that you've got coming up, what you're writing on now, some of the productions that you've had, and how you felt about those productions. So thank you, David, for being with us today. We're going to hold you here if you don't mind staying with us just a little bit longer. I think this is an interesting conversation for both people in the theater, actors, techs, and other playwrights, and it's also interesting, I hope, for the patrons of theaters to learn a little bit about the process. So this is Dale Morris with Michael Thomas Tower and Kelly Lipchinski. We're talking with David Weiner, and we'll be right back.
In the winter of 1911, a team of British explorers struggles across a frozen wasteland, only to discover that the Norwegian team has beat them to the South Pole. Their attempt to return home would later be discovered in journals found on the frozen body of Captain Scott, whose brave expedition knew that suffering and death would be their only reward. Inukshuk Productions remembers these explorers with Ted Talley's Terra Nova, playing at Sixth at Penn Theatre April 18th through May 11th. Tickets can be purchased online at sixthatpenn.com or by calling 619-688-9210.
Welcome back to San Diego Theater Scene Follow Spot Podcast. We're talking with David Weiner, who is a playwright here in San Diego. He's had his work produced quite substantially. The truth is, David, that a lot of us who write plays and have written plays for years, Michael Thomas Tower and myself both have written multiple plays, we've never had one published. We can write plays all our lives, never get one published.
Again, the opportunity seems to be with the two-hander and the one-acts and the short one-acts.
The problem is, you give me a two-hander and I can't build an audience.
Oh, yeah. The publishing and the audience are two different things. Publishers that put out a lot of these short plays for use in schools. That's why they'll put them out, and also for, you know, like evenings of one acts. But to build an audience, you're absolutely right. You're going to need the full length, and it had better be good.
Yeah, it better have five or six characters yep. to help you bring in family members and friends who want to see those people on stage.
Absolutely.
But yeah. the point is, being a playwright, unless you're Neil Simon or one of these guys and gals who are getting their plays performed consistently, you're not going to make any money.
No, my experience, even in writing, unless you're actually hired by a magazine or a newspaper or you work in a media publications department, it's not very likely you can make a living just off of your writing.
Then why do we do it? What's up with that?
Well, on occasion you get something produced, and it almost makes it worthwhile.
Yeah.
It's like anything in the arts. Most people do what they do for the love of it.
Yeah.
They
it's
can't,
almost
they've
why
got
you
do
anything
it.
In theater. As an actor in San Diego, why do you do it?
What? You can't
you
make a living
rent?
As an actor in San Diego?
But believe me, most actors can't make a living anywhere.
Exactly.
You know,
well, painters,
to make
poets,
sure.
whatever it is. Yeah. Sculptors, they're not making a living at it. They're doing
right.
it.
Van Gogh didn't make a dime. Van Gogh never sold a painting while he was alive. Mm. Isn't that something?
That's why a lot of people, they go into the teaching aspect of it, but that's not easy to find work in either.
Fact is, you've had some plays produced. You're proud of that. What are you working on right now?
Actually, I'm still working on the one-acts and short plays, because that seems to be where a lot of the production action is, and at the same time working on a full-length play. The one-acts and short pieces have been, this year it's been fairly active. There was a play festival in San Juan Capistrano called Show Off. They do that, I think, every year. And I did second prize in that, which was very nice. These are full productions,
yeah,
not
second
readings.
Prizes, is there a cash involved? Or
well, this one was. This wasn't too bad.
How much was it, David?
This is $300 for second prize.
$300. All right, yeah. So there it is, folks.
Yeah.
David works his brain out on a play, submits it to a festival,
right.
And boy, he gets $300.
And I'm thrilled.
And you know what? He's thrilled about that.
I'm bragging about it to my family. So they ask me how I'm doing as a writer, and I say, well, I'm making in the middle three figures. And they look at me oddly and say, gee, you know, probably most actors could say the same thing. Yeah. And
here's the point. We're proud of that $300.
Oh, yeah. The
applause, more than anything, that reaction to what you've written or what you've created, that's
they accepted me. They found what you did compelling enough to pay you $300 for it.
And part of the other thrill is, once they put up a play competition or a submission notice, they're going to get hundreds. So if you get into the semifinals, feel good about that, because you probably are in a field of maybe 250 or 300 other people for almost any of these things. Once they post nationally and put up a submission notice somewhere, they're going to get inundated.
But you're
still
working on that play? Is that what you were saying?
That one is pretty much polished up. That one is now going to be done in Kelly's event, the New Perspectives Festival. It's called An Honest Arrangement, and the one in San Juan Capistrano was Bride on the Rocks. That was also done in New York at their 15-minute play festival. The one the year before, 2006, won Best Play in that one back east, and that's the one that's going to be at Kelly's festival, New Perspectives. That's this summer, right?
The last two weekends in June, the New Perspective Festival, which leads me to a question I had for you. The first exposure I had to your work was Lewis and Irving, the movie moguls.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And in that, you featured an actress named Michelle DeFrancesco.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Who, when you did An Honest Arrangement at the Actors Alliance, I also believe appeared there.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and she is in your piece here at Challenge Theater 3 as well.
Mm-hmm.
How did you strike up that relationship with an actor for your pieces?
Very, very lucky. If you wind up connecting with good actors, you really are very blessed, because then you know people who can put your stuff across. Michelle, I was introduced to through David Retteray, who's a great actor here in town. Mm-hmm. And he played one of the main parts in The Master Forger. And he knew Michelle, and that's how I got to know Michelle. And the two of them have been in a number of the short plays I've written. In fact, the one that won in New York, Dave was in the original cast, and Michelle has been in it. And there's another local actress who's also excellent, Karina Montgomery, and she's been in my stuff too. So if you're fortunate enough to know good actors, this gives you a lot of open doors, because you can go to them and say, hey, I got a piece, let's see if we can get it up somewhere. And you know they're going to do a great job with it. So I've been very fortunate with these people.
And I wanted to ask you about another collaboration too, and at the risk of being crude, I suppose, I noticed you're affiliated with a director for this piece in Challenge Theater 3 that you have worked with before. I wonder if it gave you any moment's pause as David Wiener to be affiliated with the director, Jessica Seaman.
You know, somebody has mentioned that to me before. And just too much of a gentleman to say anything.
Wait, I don't get it.
So it's, you know, I try and ignore the coincidence, and so does she.
I think I've killed Dale.
Right, yeah. But we get along very well, which isn't surprising. So.
Yeah, she's lovely as well.
Yeah, she's great. Yeah, Jessica.
And she will be directing a New Perspectives as well.
Yeah, Jessica was. Actually, I think New Perspectives is a guy named David Sein, S-E-I-N.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
yeah.
David Sein is directing your piece.
Right.
Jessica is directing another piece in that festival.
Oh, great. Yeah, Jessica's wonderful. I met her through a theater, actually, in the East County. It was called Applause. And Jessica is active with them and is now, I think she works at the Globe now. And she's a very talented director. She's very good with this piece. She's quite young, which is nice, because when you write something new, it's nice to get somebody who's eager and interested in doing something different.
David, thank you. This has been wonderful. I think that playwrights could listen in to what you had to say today and learn a lot. I don't know if it's all positive.
Well, playwriting is definitely not all positive, like acting or anything else. Yeah. No, not all positive.
You just got to go out there and do it.
Yeah, positive stuff is great when it happens.
The hardest part about that, I think, well, any area of the arts and certainly in acting or writing, is selling yourself.
Oh, yeah.
That's the hardest part and the thing that we least like to do.
Yeah, it's the Willie Loman part.
Yeah, well, I remember in the 80s when I was very, very seriously trying to write plays, of buying, you know, all these thick envelopes, setting down, addressing them all, putting in the sace, making copy after copy. And, you know, making copies of your play back then wasn't so cheap.
It's not cheap now.
It's not cheap now.
Postage is not cheap.
Postage is not cheap. It'd be a project for a weekend.
Oh, it's horribly time-consuming.
And then not getting any response many times, and you were just so happy to get a note.
But haven't electronic submissions taken a lot of that pressure off of you?
Well, it depends on what their submission policy is. A lot of places, hard copy only still.
Huh.
And most places now, you will not hear from us unless we're interested. So you drop it down the hole, and most of the time, you know, just given the way the statistics work out, you will never hear from them.
Yeah. I want to get a hard copy. We've had a policy at Six of Pen for some of our programs, such as Q Plays and Challenge Theater, even, I believe, that we would accept emailed versions. However, what I end up doing is printing them out anyway.
Well, you know, for something like what we did with this, it's the first time I've worked with getting electronic submissions in this way. I'll never do it another way.
I won't either. I did not want hard copies at all for New Perspective.
Oh, I take them in, I classify them, I have them filed in such a way that I can rename them as I go through them if they shift into.
Do you print them out though, or read them?
I print out the. Okay, well, I'm going to tell a little secret here, and I think it's probably true for most people that have to read a whole lot of scripts. I don't read every page of every script that comes in.
The first 8 or 10 pages?
Because, well, I'll usually go farther than that. But if it hasn't grabbed me by page 20 or 25,
mm-hmm. I'm done.
Mm-hmm. I'm not going to go into
You go further than I do.
I'll try to go that far.
How many plays mm-hmm. did you read
And yet there are some, by the fifth page, I wouldn't put that down for anything. I'm going to go the whole way with it. So I don't read all of them all the way. There are some, by the time I'll get to page 10, I'm ready to run the whole thing out because I know I'm going to read the whole thing.
So you will print it.
Until I was looking for a venue, when I had to know whether language was going to be an issue, we had already made our selections. I didn't print out a single play that was sent to New Perspective. I printed them out when I wanted to go through very detailed analysis of the plays to see what the language issues were going to be, what the staging issues were going to be. Not until I got to that point with a script did I ever put it onto a piece of paper.
How many plays did you receive for Q Plays, for
148.
So you at least read 10, 15, 20 pages of all of those plays.
Oh, yes.
Okay, I'm going to bring up a controversial subject here that you and I have talked about in the past. Send us your play with a check for $10. We have to have play readers. How do you feel about that, David?
I did a lot of play reading at La Jolla Playhouse during the internship and also the season I was there as a dramaturgy associate. And one of the policies that they don't have there that some theaters do are what you're talking about, 10 pages only. Send us the first 10 pages and a synopsis. And to my mind, that's the way to go because you can either write or you can't. And after reading 10 pages of somebody's play, you'll know if the subject matter suits what you want to do. You can tell if they can write, particularly if they can write, you know, for the stage. And one of the things that I did there was when I read a play, I'd read every page and then write up the evaluation. That's time consuming. And it's slow work, especially if you need to note page numbers for the artistic director or literary manager, like here's a scene that worked, here's a scene that didn't. So I would really advise theaters to set up some sort of policy where they just, you know, please submit 10 to 15 pages and synopsis. I really think that
would be. How do you feel about that, Mike?
If we were doing hard copies, yes.
Yeah.
I would say that. But when it's electronic, you can read those first 10 pages on screen, And then if you want to read the rest of it, you've got it there to read. That's what I like about the electronic submission. It's so easy to handle. Another thing about this, if you want somebody else to read it, you can just ship it off to them as an email attachment.
Well, what we did, we set up a password-protected blog. Blogger is free.
It's wonderful.
And we put every play that was submitted up on a blogger and allowed our directors to access the plays that way with a password so that they were not published to the world.
Which in your case, they were up there blind, so they didn't know the scripts they were reading,
exactly.
Which
there
is
were
the only
no,
way you can do it locally.
No authors' names attached to the pieces. They read just the text and said whether they liked it or didn't like it. That was the selection process went that way, and the for the readers, which ones we were going to do, and for the directors, which ones they were interested in. And
that's a good system. I think that's a good idea.
And we never used a sheet of paper. So it's absolutely green. We didn't charge submission fees or readers' fees. We don't have membership dues. Everything that we've done thus far has been free and paperless.
Yeah, but let's talk about, if we can, submission fees. Yeah. That was the point of my question, although I loved where that conversation just went. But the point of my question was, I can't read 180 plays. I'm going to have to farm some of this out. They're going to charge me $5 a play to read it and give me an evaluation. How do we feel about that?
I don't like the idea of pay-to-play. This and a large local festival, many of us felt last year, it was a pay-to-play festival. You had to be a member. You had to pay to have your play read.
What was
you had
this?
The Actors Alliance. I mean, that's
no,
one of...
No, they don't charge you.
Yes, they did charge playwright submission fees.
Well,
yes, they did.
No, it's not a submission fee. Actually, what they're doing there, that's really kind of different. It's more like a fringe festival. They're helping to pay production costs, but they recoup part of that, or maybe all of it.
I don't understand.
It really is.
Well, no one got paid last year, so no one recouped any of that. And that was basically what we wanted to avoid in our case.
Yeah.
And that's how we felt. A submission fee came across. We were volunteering to read. This was our, I don't know about farming it out. We had a team of four people who read and rated, and the things that got three yeses or two yeses and a maybe are the things that are being produced.
Yeah.
I'm very much opposed to submission fees, and Dale knows this. A lot of publications, such as Dramatist Guild, when they put their information out, they've taken the approach that they will not list anything that has a submission fee unless it's made transparent, which means they tell what they've used it for.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we already know what they were using it for. To me, that doesn't really change anything at all.
Yeah, they're generally dead set against it. They don't, Dramatist Guild does not like the idea. But, you know, I can see your point. If you're going to have to get people to do it, they're either going to have to be dedicated volunteers or you're going to have to offer them a little sum.
If you can't afford to do it without getting submission fees, you can't afford to do the project.
And that's where I was with so many things in theater. If you're not willing to put the time in and read them, don't call for them. Don't hold a festival. Don't ask for plays if you're not going to have the time to read them.
And my contention is, if you expect the playwrights to pay for that, then start charging actors for auditions, which actually I've heard some people that are for that.
No, pay to play across
the board,
no.
You know, if you're going to submit a resume for anything in the theater, send us some money before we'll even look at it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know,
it sucks.
Yeah.
If you're going to set up a bribe system, at least tell us what we're going to get.
Yeah.
You know.
Well,
nobody puts out more time and money to get the product out there than a playwright does. And then they say, oh, but pay us to even look at it.
Well, exactly. Why give me $15 so I can read your play so that if I do your play, maybe I can give you your $15 back. Let's cut out the middleman. You keep your money. I'll try to make what
I can. It's a lottery.
From it.
That's what it boils down to. When they ask for a submission fee, it's a lottery. And I've had that contention with an organization here in town. I don't know if I should mention it.
Mention it.
Fritz Blitz.
Mm-hmm.
Fritz Blitz charges, I think it's 25 now.
Are you serious? I didn't know that.
I'm not swearing the amount, but I think that's
they
what
charge
it is.
For submission?
Oh, yes. Oh, I've been around and around with them on this.
Them who?
Dwayne.
Dwayne
Daniels.
Candace? Dwayne Daniels,
yep.
Yeah. What's his rap with?
That's funding that we rely on, and that's when I said, then you can't afford the festival. His response was, well, are you telling us then we shouldn't just do the festival? I said, no. My response is, go get your funding from someplace.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were talking about it, and this has been a couple of years or more ago, I said, I would love to come to your board and talk to them about this. I volunteer to help you go find that funding. He said, great, we'd love to have you. Well, that's the last I heard of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so they're still charging submission fees.
Well, I'm surprised at that.
I won't submit, and I encourage every other writer not to submit.
No, I won't submit either. No.
Yeah, they'll let you know on their sites, at least. I mean, and you can tell right away if there's some, you know, festivals out there that are known for chiseling on occasion, and then they'll hit you with a fee later after
you're
in the semifinals.
Help me understand what that means.
There have been in the past some shady festivals that will take a submission for free and then say, hey, you're in the semifinals, but we need 50 more bucks to decide who's going to be in the finals.
Oh, you won the London lottery.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, that, you know, it doesn't happen often, but occasionally it does. And when these things, you know, the Dramatists Guild is pretty good about identifying these things in their magazine. They're pretty much against this fee in any shape, way, shape, or form, except, like you said, you know, if they can be transparent, that's one thing.
Well, I hope we can get this podcast out to playwrights, both rookies and people who've had more experience at it, because these are things that need to be known and need to be talked about. And our conversation here has really evolved into the kind of conversation I want to have on this podcast. So, David,
great.
Thank you very much. This has turned into a 30-minute segment here all of a sudden?
22.
That's okay. We can do that because we run the thing.
It's your show.
It's our show. We can do that.
Nobody tells us we have to shut down.
That's right. This is Dale Morris. We're sitting with David Wiener, playwright, who we've just had a great conversation with. Michael Thomas Tower, who's also a playwright. Thank you for your contributions, Michael. Appreciate it very much. Kelly Lepchinski. We'll see you next week. Who we got coming next week?
Delisha Turner Sonnenberg and Rob Appel will be back to tip his hat to some form of art.
And we've got a couple of surprises for you, too. So we'll see you next week. This is San Diego Theater Scene Follow Spot Podcast. Bye.
This has been Follow Spot, a podcast service of San Diego Theater Scene Incorporated, a nonprofit organization for the arts in San Diego, California. We invite you to visit our website, sdtheaterscene.com, for current comprehensive news and information about performance activities in San Diego County. Your host for this program has been Dale Morris, assisted by Kelly Lepchinski, who is also program coordinator, and Michael Thomas Tower, who is also engineer and announcer. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to your being with us again soon.